This is Backstory with us, the American History Guys. I'm Peter Onuf, 18th Century Guy.
I'm Ed Ayers, your 19th Century Guy.
And I'm Brian Bella, 20th Century History Guy.
I am appealing to the people of America tonight to help in carrying out a task that is important to them and to their government.
That, of course, is Franklin Delano Roosevelt in one of his famous fireside chats. It was November 1937. The Depression had been going on for 8 years, and the government was still trying to figure out just how bad things were. And so FDR went on the radio, and he appealed for help in conducting a nationwide census, a census of the unemployed.
Enforced idleness, embracing any considerable portion of our people in a nation of such wealth and natural opportunity, is a paradox that challenges our ingenuity.
72 years later, it looks like that paradox is still very much with us. At last count, the national unemployment rate was hovering just under 10%. That's a 25-year high and just a few percentage points under where it was when FDR got on the radio that night.
On each episode of Backstory, we tear a topic from the headlines and spend an hour exploring its historical context. Today, almost 2 years into the worst recession since the 1930s, our topic is unemployment and the experience of looking for work in America. What does it mean to be out of work here, and what has it meant in the past? How has the search for work shaped people's lives throughout our history?
Those are great questions, Peter. But you know, one thing really bothers me. You know, we've already heard today's show, unemployment almost always conjures up images of the Great Depression in Bryan's century.
Right.
And it just seems to me that it's very likely that people were out of work and looking for work long before the Great Depression. So, Peter,
yeah,
as my colleague in the pre-20th century era, help me out here.
Well, I want to assure you, Ed, before I talk about my period, that you invented unemployment. And so, and you can explain why in a minute. I mean, simply, it's that you couldn't have unemployment until there was employment, meaning that you had to have parts of the population depending on regular work, on wages, and that's not the experience of the vast majority of Americans in the colonial period. People who worked in colonial America were largely self-sufficient farmers, and even if it was hard producing surpluses for market in order to get that little extra income that Americans have always loved to have, it was never a problem about living. The whole idea of famine, dearth, people dying of starvation, that was not an American experience.
So, Peter, I get it. There's not employment, so there can't be unemployment. But, you know, there must have been good years and bad years. People's lives must have been affected by that. Okay, maybe we didn't call it unemployment.
Yeah.
Like, what happens when it doesn't rain and there's a drought?
Well, in colonial America, there's plenty of rain.
You're going to be difficult, aren't you, Peter?
I should say there's plenty of land. People move a lot. Mobility is crucial on the employment front. The great challenge in New England is big families. People would have to move out into new areas. New townships were granted in western Massachusetts and what became Vermont and New Hampshire. And later, New Englanders move all over.
So you might call that looking for work. Kind of.
You could indeed, looking for, but I would say looking for subsistence, or a word that's better in this context is looking for competency.
Something I've been looking for years.
Well,
keep on looking, man. Keep on.
There's always a market for competency.
Okay, I'm done with my popcorn. I'm done with these previews. Let's get to the main feature. Let's clear the mics.
You mean I'm
Let's
unemployed.
Clear the mic. You are out of
I'm
work.
I'm unemployed.
You are looking for work. Let's clear the mics for the all-important 19th century.
Oh, boy, I tell you, with an introduction like that, it's just like that Star Wars introduction with the big letters sort of screaming. Unemployment really is a byproduct of, you know, we used to call it the Industrial Revolution. We pull that apart into various components now and done it in such sweeping ways, which was really accelerated, ironically, by something you might not associate with process, which is the War of 1812. When trade with England slowed or stopped, it created sort of an artificial environment for industry in the American North to begin flourishing.
Yeah, great
so
point.
When you have that, then people go, boy, there are profits to be made here. And we really do have enough capital that we can organize our capital and our physical place to create these manufactories, which, you know, are nothing like what we would think of today as factories. They'd be something more we think of today as shops, where you'd have maybe four or five people working. But the fact is, even when you have four or five people working, when suddenly the demand for what you're producing is glutted, when you've made as many shoes or gloves or hats or whatever as the local market can bear, then what you do? You say, I'm sorry, I no longer need to employ you right now. Maybe come back next year.
And Ed, when did we start getting those cycles?
Well, this came very quickly once it began. So all that's going on in a really heated way throughout the 1830s and 40s and 50s. The Civil War comes along, and what that does is really turns it up even more in the North. There's a boom economy, and unemployment's very low. But at the end of the Civil War, slam. All that demand ends. You have all these hundreds of thousands of soldiers coming back home. And this is when you start having the word tramp first enter the American lexicon, because tramping had been what Sherman's soldiers were doing in Georgia, sort of living off the land, feeding yourself. And then people are trying to get back to that superheated environment of the late antebellum wartime. And people are pumping all kinds of money into building railroads and factories. And this is happening in the South as well. And then, as a result of that superheated environment, the Panic of 1873, the worst that the United States had ever seen here 8 years after the war. And it dislocates the entire American economy, sets everything back, and sets enormous numbers of people at loose across the American landscape looking for work.
Yeah, well, that's pretty impressive, Ed. But there's something that you left out of that account. You left out the genesis of the term itself, unemployed. Conveniently enough, I recently sat down with a Harvard historian who's written about this precise issue. His name is Alex Kasar, and the book is Out of Work, The First Century of Unemployment in Massachusetts. Alex explains that the word unemployed does show up in the state census rolls going all the way back to the Civil War, but before the 1870s, it referred to a very different class of people.
The typical person was a child under the age of 10, or women over the age of 50. It was clear that the word meant people who were, you know, not employed. They did not hold jobs. Mm-hmm. Within a few years, the very same state agency used the word in what we now recognize as its modern meaning, meaning people who normally do work but can't find a job.
Turns out that there was one guy who was mainly responsible for this radical shift in the word's meaning. He was a Massachusetts official named Carol Wright, who would go on to run the National Bureau of Labor Statistics. Wright was concerned about these huge estimates of joblessness that people were throwing around. And so Wright came up with a new method of crunching the numbers, a method that has pretty much lasted up till now. Here's Kasar again.
A directive was sent around the state saying, only count those who really authentically want to work and you know will work. Don't count any of these malingerers, leaving it up to the subjective judgment of the people doing the counting. And so he was really setting out quite deliberately to establish that unemployment rates were lower. Right now, I mean, you know, since the late 1930s, 1940, our unemployment statistics are drawn out of something called the Current Population Survey. And there, it's not the judgment of an examiner so much as there is a criteria that you have to meet, which is that you have to demonstrate that you have been searching for work or looking for work. Someone who is not employed and cannot demonstrate that they have been looking for work in recent weeks ceases to be counted as unemployed and is counted as, quotes, not in the labor force.
So do you tie this to some great capitalist conspiracy, or are you more inclined to say that there really is something called the Protestant work ethic that Americans care deeply or intensely about, and it somehow has worked its way even into the way we collect data about work?
Well, I don't think it's a great capitalist conspiracy. It was far more inchoate than that. I think what the fear is finally grounded in, or the apprehension is grounded in, is if these people are really unemployed through no fault of their own, if they're really suffering, then society should have some obligation to help them.
Right.
But God forbid, what if we help people who are just lazy?
Right.
You know, and just don't want to work. And that keeps surfacing all the time. I mean, even with the charitable organizations, which had a little bit of public funds, but mostly private funds in the 1890s, to get relief from one of these charitable organizations, and relief meant a pittance, I mean, some wood, some food, you know, a little bit of money maybe to pay a doctor. To get relief, they sent somebody to your house to make sure that you were genuinely impoverished and had nothing. And it's a willingness to perceive poor people as being lazy, as being shiftless. I think that current runs throughout U.S. history and certainly is present in policies up through the present.
Well, I would add another component, which really comes from my reading of your book, and that is that there is a hesitancy to acknowledge the permanent amount of unemployment that is there. And something like 20% of workers experience unemployment during the course of a year, even in good years.
That's correct. In the late 19th century and in the 20th century up until the 1930s, mm-hmm. the percentage of the labor force who were unemployed at all in the course of a year, mm-hmm. that figure looks in a good year, looks like it's somewhere between 17 and 22% of all people experience some unemployment for an average of about 3 months.
That's remarkable.
It's a remarkable statistic. And what it tells you is how chronic a presence and a threat this was to people who held blue-collar jobs. And you're quite right also that the deep reluctance in policy circles.
We don't like to admit that it exists.
Right. We don't want to say that in any given year, even in a good year, you know, 13, 14 to 18% of the labor force is unemployed at some point during the year. We don't want to think about that. We don't want to see that. We do see this as this cyclical phenomenon which, alas, surprise, gasp, seems to have happened again.
Well, I want to thank you for joining us today, Alex.
Thank you, Brian. It's really been a pleasure.
Alexander Kasar is a professor of history and social policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. He's the author of The Right to Vote, The Contested History of Democracy. He's also the author of Out of Work, The First Century of Unemployment in Massachusetts.
I'm looking for a job from 9 to 5.
This is Backstory, the show that looks to the past to explain the America of today. I'm Peter Onuf, your guide to the 18th century.
I'm Ed Ayers, your guide to the 19th century.
And I'm Brian Bellow, guide to the 20th century. We're talking today about unemployment and the experience of looking for work throughout American history. As we do with each of our shows, we've been inviting your feedback about today's topic on our website. And our producers have invited a few of you who left comments there to join us on the phone. Peter, who's up first today?
It's Bob from St. Louis, Missouri. Bob, welcome to Backstory.
Hi, thanks for having me.
All right, so you got a question about this, Bob?
I do. I thought that I'd ask a question about perceptions of being underemployed.
Yeah.
The notion of not having enough to do or not living up to your full potential.
Right.
What types of standards have Americans applied to decide whether or not someone's work was adequate to their status or capacity?
Yeah. Well, I'm going to make a simple, bold statement and suggest that from our beginnings, it's been a central tenet of American ideology that aristocrats are bad. And the definition of an aristocrat is somebody who doesn't work or lives off the work of others. Somehow this didn't apply to slave owners who imagined that they were working hard in their own way.
Right.
Well, there's a lot of managing to do or something.
Well, that's the way they would explain it. In fact, there is a heavy premium in Protestant culture on what we call the work ethic, going back to Max Weber's famous sociological argument about how Protestants are constantly trying to prove themselves to themselves and to their God in this direct, unmediated relationship. You can't hide from God. He sees that you're slacking. So that notion of examining yourself and holding yourself to a high standard is one that, in a way, goes public. It becomes a public standard. So people in America have to justify themselves. You notice this when Americans meet strangers, they say, "What do you do?" As if the definition of a person is the work they do. Mm-hmm. Whereas people from other cultures might say,
do you come from? Where did you get that funny accent? That sounds posh to me. You must be an aristocrat.
In St. Louis, it's where'd you go to high school, but that's...
Where'd you go to high school? Right. They still have a few high schools in St. Louis, right? It's the great shrinking metropolis of the...
It sure is.
...middle America. What, about 300,000 people there now?
If that.
Oh, sad story. Well, hold on. Don't leave.
Well, Bob, I like Peter's answer, and I think the corollary in the 20th century is the rise of credentialing. When more and more Americans start going to universities and start getting fancy titles and...
You mean PhDs?
Well, not even PhDs, but they start getting MBAs. They become doctors, and... That opens the doorway for being underemployed because we're not actually using that knowledge, actually deploying it.
Boy, you know, but I'm sorry. So Peter has the highfalutin, you know, Protestant work ethic, I think Max Weber.
Yeah, pretty good.
And, you know, Brian credentialing, you know. It strikes me there's a lot of anxiety in the 19th century, just so happens to be my century, where people are really worried about not producing to their maximum effect. And that really becomes sort of a product of the late 19th. It sort of bleeds over to the early of Taylorism and sort of, I want to have a special word too.
And what would Taylorism be, Ed?
Well, Frederick W. Taylor.
Winslow.
Frederick Winslow Taylor, right? He was a consultant, one of the first probably in the United States, who came into factories and studied the most minute movements to time motion studies, right? And he would sit there with a stopwatch and measure how long it took the best workers to perform some task. The whole idea that you could rationalize the work process so that no one was underemployed at any moment.
You know what we figured out in the 20th century? We figured out, psychologists figured out, that the best way to squeeze work out of people was to observe them and pay attention to them.
Wow.
That
wow.
Those Taylorites that kind of tried to measure things and give people quotas, they had nothing on the soft, caring psychologists who came in to observe and study workers.
This is
workers.
Like Jeremy Bentham's panopticon.
They found out that when you observe workers and pay attention to them and make them feel wanted, you can get all kinds of
but
work
you know what?
Out of
yeah.
them.
I
think the real question is the extent to which we've internalized this surveillance or observation regime you're talking about. And we over-educated humanists. We observe ourselves constantly.
And now we Twitter
working.
About it, Peter.
Right. This is a depressing thought. It's been great talking to you, though, Bob. Thanks for calling.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks a lot, Bob.
Right.
Bye-bye.
If you're just tuning in, this is Backstory, and we're talking about the history of looking for work in America. You know, guys, so far we've talked about the how we wound up with this phenomenon of unemployment, people moving from farms, industrialization. But we haven't said much about the who of all of this. So tell me, who exactly are we talking about when we talk about unemployment? And who are we talking about when we talk about employment, for that matter, in the 19th century?
Well, Brian, that would have been a huge part of the American population. So let's talk about the people who were notorious by natives for being unemployed, and that's the immigrants, and especially the Irish, who come in the 1840s and 1850s in desperate need of work, but to the eyes of people who were already living here, just didn't really seem that interested in working. Now, the irony, of course, is that the Irish did a lot of the heavy work of the whole United States at this time, especially in the north, of digging the canals and unloading the ships and all that.
But it wasn't as if those Yankees were inviting the Irish to employment. Irish need not apply and other kinds of invidious distinctions.
Well, if Irish need not apply, then they needed to go on to somewhere else. And
that's exactly right.
The Irish became known really for being itinerant, of constantly being on the move, looking for work. And they were famous for living in shanty towns and so forth. So unemployment, I think, would have first become visible with a kind of an ethnic face on it of the Irish. Does that make sense to you, Peter?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
But the largest group of Americans who had jobs would have talked about, worried about, become enraged by, was the enormous enslaved population of post-Civil War South. And there's a case where they worked so hard and had been working so hard their entire lives and wanted only to be left free to work hard for themselves.
Yeah, right, exactly.
And almost immediately were sucked into having to work for somebody else. And if they didn't do that, they were considered lazy.
One of the interesting things that happens is, of course, labor markets close down for free blacks in the North, and there's a good deal of segregation, both residentially and at the workplace. And it's a sense, I think, that Americans had, a kind of a sense of themselves as American patriots and citizens. They had a kind of a right to work, almost a property in certain occupations and jobs. It's as if they take the idea of an independent landholding and extend it, even when they leave the farm. They take with them a sense of privilege, a sense of being somebody who ought to be favored. And people like the Irish or freed blacks or any group that's strange and unfamiliar that threatens their traditional way of life, it's very, very upsetting. I think you can't talk about unemployment and employment without talking about nativism, about prejudice, racial and ethnic.
And that's a great point, because today you think about how unemployment is defined. We're going to lose our jobs to all those foreigners, you know,
and you're
shipping off American jobs and these kind of things. It's very rare that unemployment is just seen as a neutral social fact. It's usually entangled in other identities.
Both in terms of the threat and in terms of the reality. I mean, today, and this is one of the saddest facts about unemployment, the unemployment rate among African Americans is twice what it is for white Americans.
And among Hispanic Americans, it's enormously high as well.
Exactly.
But the irony is, of course, is that the people who are working hardest to find jobs are then somehow stigmatized not wanting to work.
Right.
So in that wide-ranging discussion, we covered vast expanses of American history. But, you know, there's sometimes in American history, some places where we simply can't really imagine unemployment. And the West is one of those places. Now, you picture it being the scene of unlimited opportunity. But as it turns out, the American West was a place where the very expectations of high employment led to a lot of social unrest surrounding it. To really help us enter into that understanding of that moment, we're really fortunate to have a historical recreation by our own Catherine Moore, an imagining of what it might have been like to have been one of those men who caught a train in the East to head west. So here's a scenario. You're in Seattle. The year is 1910. You're a new arrival from back east, and you find your way down to Skid Row, where you hear you might be able to get work for the day on a lumber crew. No such luck, but what you do find is a grizzled old man who buys you a drink and launches into the story of how he wound up out of work in the new Northwest.
Life changes quickly here. In 30-odd years since I came to the new Northwest, I've been a driller, blaster, mucker, pick boy, faller, choker setter, whistle punk, separator man, oiler, driver, boomer, longshoreman, and sackor. Every man who comes out here brings his own dream. Mine took shape the day I saw that thing they call the wishing train back in Chicago. One day I showed up for work and the doors of the factory were closed, so I kept walking straight into the fairgrounds. And sitting there next to the midway, I saw a railway car. Its sides were painted with big, bright letters. Low price railroad lands on easy terms. Farming, grazing, timber, irrigated garden lands, extensive coal and iron lands in rich mineral districts. Admission free, free, free. It was like walking into a treasure chest. Sheaves of grain, precious stones, honey, wild game, jars filled with fruit. There was a man with the railroad standing there, told me that anyone with hands to work could have all that and more. He said a man could make his own life in the Northwest, work for himself, get free from the shackles of wage slavery. I decided then and there to make my way to the land of fortune, find one of those homesteads, and live off the fat of the land. Huh. When I got here, I found out nothing in the Northwest is really free except promises. So I fell into the steadiest work there is out here, the unsteady kind. I'm not the only one. There are thousands of us. We never stay too long in any place. That's the nature of it. If the price of copper falls, we come pouring out of the mines and take to the rails. a month in a lumber camp, 2 months in the mines, a couple weeks harvesting. A lot of us came here to escape the yoke of industry. But sometimes I think we're nothing but living machines, not even treated so well as horses. After all, when the horse is out of work, he's glad of it. When the wage worker's out of work, he is up against it. To some, we're just tramps. More polite society knows us as casual laborers, but there's nothing casual about it as far as I know. I'm a worker, plain and simple, ready and willing to work, if only there's work to be done. When there's not, things can get ugly, like the year I arrived, 1885. And nights of labor drove 700 Chinese from the city of Tacoma on a trail of blood. And they tried the same thing in Seattle. The government had to declare martial law. Those were hard years to be looking for work. And the bleaker their prospects, the fiercer men get towards outsiders. Last time I was in Portland, I saw a railroad pamphlet laying on the ground. On the cover, a farmer was plowing up gold coins from the Montana soil. It said that soon they're going to open up the reservations to whites. Land for the asking, land for the taking. Maybe when the snows come, instead of heading back to the Skid Row, I'll make a stop in the Treasure State and see what kind of work I can dig up.
That was an excerpt from a piece of historical fiction written by one of our producers, Catherine Moore. It was read by Kate Burke, a drama professor here at the University of Virginia. You can listen to the entire piece and see some powerful images in the form of an audio slideshow on our website, backstoryradio.org. You know, what Catherine's piece evokes so beautifully is the sense of longing and possibility that's always been throughout American history, but was really stepped up when the railroad comes along. You know, it's probably the symbol of American movement. And here you see, you know, the image of people just sort of trapped in a field watching possibility hurtle by them in the form of a train. But what Catherine helps us do is to imagine what happens when that train comes to the end of the line. You know, it's going somewhere, and it's going somewhere for a reason, right. Which is often to move people to another place for them to work, to build more railroads, and to feed the railroad. So there's a kind of a cycle that we have, the romance of the railroad, but we forget that the railroad really was the engine of the American industrial economy.
I love that railroad engine, Ed, and it suggests that railroads are in the movement business. So they have a stake, a material stake in the American dream. Move! Go someplace. I mean, of course, much early railroad advertising has to do with the wonders of the West. See Yellowstone, they build a special hotel there. And so they're playing very self-consciously with our dreams and our fantasies.
Okay, but it seems to me that there was a huge shift in the demographics of mobility, if you will, somewhere here. Because it now seems like it's wealthier people who pick up and move. They go out to Silicon Valley. They follow the economy as it flourishes wherever. And we're talking about mainly poor people moving, looking for any kind of subsistence or, in Ed's period, a job. And when did that transition happen?
Well, I think it happened in, amazingly enough, the 19th century. and I take no great pride in this, you know. But we can see literally before our eyes, and so could Americans at the time, that things were profoundly changing. So it's not merely that, okay, hard times come, and here you are in Boston, and now there's not a job. Now the expectation is, well, there's a train station right there. You got a whole continent waiting.
Yeah.
If you can just get on that train, there's got to be a job somewhere. So it ratchets up the expectation by expanding the geographic scope of responsibility to go out and find a job.
You have no excuse.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so for the first time, you start seeing the creation really of a national labor market. Now, you'd had that before along the coast, that people would move from one coastal city to another, north to south, as, you know, different crops came in. And the cities worried about this a lot, the idea that there were, you know, this floating population. Yeah. But now with the railroad, which, of course, really burgeons after the Civil War, and what we think of as the Gilded Age, now there's a truly national labor market that could extend all the way from Philadelphia to Seattle. and all the way from New Orleans to Chicago. And people now feel like there's really no limits to how far I might move to find a job. And you can't really see what those other places look like. So you just imagine that they must be better than wherever you are now.
What I'd say is that the disappointment that we're hearing in this narrative could only exist in the context of high expectations. And the dream lives, that is the American dream, what we describe as the great incentive, the end of the rainbow, all that good stuff, that moves, literally moves people across the landscape. But I think we also need to think back of what it is that Americans imagine they're escaping. That is, the threat, the nightmare, the thing that really bothers people is to be stuck in one place forever. And that was the experience of America's ancestors. The world we have lost, the old world, is being born in one place and never being able to move away. So mobility, in a way, as an existential experience, moving is its own satisfaction. It's a melancholy satisfaction.
Well, I know that whenever the word existential comes, a short break. When we get back, we'll look at what happened when the endless stream of workers from abroad suddenly got cut off. And we'll hear more from you, our listeners.
If you'd like to be a caller on a future show, have a look at our website to see the topics we're working on. That's backstoryradio.org. We'll be back in a minute.
Production support for Backstory is provided by Marcus and Carol Weinstein, Trish and David Crow, Claire Gargalli and David Carley, Caroline Feeney, and J.M. Weinberg.